Hello there, one and all. Welcome back to Cinerama after the laptop on fire enforced delay. Coming up on this week's show, reviews, including George Clooney's new directorial effort in which he also stars Leatherheads, Michael Haneke's remake of his frankly brilliant German language original Funny Games with Funny Games US, the latest based on a Japanese horror film comes out in UK cinemas, even though I realise it came out in the US a couple of months ago with One Missed Call, and Spanish language horror, which is already getting an American remake to come out later this year with the Spanish language Wreck. Also, movie news and my top five most anticipated films of April through June. Also, DVD reviews, including a look at the Region 1 two-disc set of There Will Be Blood and the Region 2 limited collector's edition of The Assassination of Jesse James by the Coward Robert Ford. If you guys have not noticed, if you want to skip certain bits, if there's stuff that doesn't interest you, don't worry, I won't be offended. If you click on using your iPod or whatever gets you to your summary bit on your MP3 player, you will find that I have listed runtimes so that you can skip whatever you want and go on to whatever you want. What you may have noticed from that introduction, if you listened to my update last week, is that two things are missing. One, Son of Rambo. To be honest with you, I wanted to get this podcast out as close to Friday as possible. That's always my aim, to be honest with you, even though I know often that doesn't happen. So I figured Son of Rambo can wait for one more week, considering the amount of stuff I've got coming up on this week's show. That, you know, there is a lot of stuff. And also, my final part of my Coen Brothers marathon, taking a look at The Big Lebowski. I've still not managed to get a bloody copy of it. And to be honest with you, I think I'm just going to call it quits on the Coen Brothers marathon there. It's been going for 3 months now, so I think now is time. And I've done a lot of their films, so I hope you will forgive me. Not too sure about what the next marathon's going to be. Hope to start it next week, though. If you've got any ideas, I'd very much like to hear them. Please email the email line, email address even, cineramapodcast@yahoo.co.uk, or Skype the voicemail line at cineramapodcast, all lowercase, all one word. But to start this week's show, one of the big releases in the UK this week came out in the US last week, taking a look at George Clooney's Leatherheads.
Let me ask you a question. You like playing football?
I love playing football.
For a special breed of men called Leatherheads, the rules were simple.
You hit anybody that comes near him.
There were no rules.
Oh, I like him.
But when the game they love was going under...
We're broke now. Our season just started.
Time to pack it up and go home.
Dodge Conley had the plan.
It's your intention to legitimize professional football?
To build it back up.
Carter Rutherford leaves Princeton to play for the Duluth Bulldogs.
What? You ever hear of Carter Rutherford, the Bullet?
War hero football boy?
They've got a completely different style, Carter. How are you going to adjust to that?
Maybe they'll just kind of adjust to me.
So you're a sports writer?
Why not?
Hey, what's a girl doing in a press box?
Certain jobs are always going to be done by men.
Big strapping man?
Lead review of the week, taking a look at Leatherheads, directed by George Clooney. Leatherheads stars George Clooney, Renée Zellweger, John Krasinski, and Jonathan Pryce, and is the story of Dodge Calloway, played by George Clooney. I couldn't remember his name there. A professional footballer in a not very professional football league who employs Carter Rutherford, played by John Krasinski. Carter the Bullet Rutherford, who is a star player at college and a war hero. And Clooney tries to take football up to a more professional level, both in the style of play and with money. But Rutherford has a secret which Lexi Lettington, I believe, played by Renée Zellweger, knows about, as she is an investigative reporter sent to find out what the secret is. The secret is something which could damage things for Rutherford forever. Along with this, Rutherford and Calloway both start falling for her. So, quite a mixed plot there, I think you would say. So, who honestly doesn't think George Clooney is the best thing going in Hollywood at the moment. The man appeals to all demographics. He has a very high success rate, both critically and commercially. He, along with Steven Soderbergh, have produced some of the most interesting films of the last few years. He can act pretty bloody well, and his first two directorial efforts, Confessions of a Dangerous Mind, a rather underseen and underrated film, which I really do rate, and Good Night and Good Luck, both marked him out as a filmmaker to watch, the latter earning him an Oscar nomination for directing in the same year he won a Best Supporting Actor Oscar for Syriana. The man is virtually peerless in film at the moment, and so I went into his new film Leatherheads with some excitement. Films about American football do not usually do well in the UK. To be honest, no one in the UK knows how to play it or doesn't really watch it. But if anyone is going to make a movie about it and it do well internationally, you think it would be George Clooney. Right from the start, his intentions are laid on the table. An old-school Universal logo spins before we are introduced to a sepia-toned world of professional American football scored by the rather plinky-plonky tones of Randy Newman. Before there was anything professional to American football. Clooney inhabits this world with gesticulating fools and smoking children, showing a world where no one seems to have grown up. This introduction sequence takes a long time to get going, as Clooney sets up a slow pace which is followed through the whole of the film, and raises one of its most serious problems. The film he is making is a screwball romantic comedy of the like Hollywood released in their dozens up till the late 1950s, which contained fast-moving plots and dialogue which bounced around the room. The film he has actually made, though, falls flat on both counts. For a comedy to be just shy of 2 hours, it needs to be either consistently funny throughout, or contain an engaging plot, which feels as if it could not be wrapped up in any less time. Leatherheads, though, takes its sweet time to do anything of note, with virtually every scene playing too long, and Clooney shows a previously unseen lack of restraint with his editing. Montage sequences seem to happen every 10 minutes for very little reason. Entire scenes, an escape from a speakeasy comes to mind, feel rather pointless aside from injecting a little action into the piece, and overall the film feels as if it could have easily been at least 20 minutes shorter. With Good Night and Good Luck, Clooney showed that he can make a film which tells a story, and an important one at that, and bring it in with fantastic results in less than 90 minutes. It is easy to see where he has slipped up. He obviously has great affection for the films he is trying to ape, and he tries his hardest for us to see it that way also, but this aspect just fails. It does not help that by casting himself, Clooney has set up a major stumbling block in the film's central love triangle. While I will try not to spoil the film's resolution, things happen exactly as you imagine they will. There is no real suspense, and to be honest, the treatment of one of the characters really is rather bizarre, painting him as actually quite a bad guy, in a way I felt was rather unnecessary. We do not need an outright bad guy in this film, two dueling alpha males is enough, and the way it is done feels rather contrived, and despite a neat wrap-up for that particular character near the end of the film, it feels like they have never had much of a chance in a film where they should have provided one of the more engaging threads, and indeed one of the more engaging characters. Clooney has always been rather self-deprecating in real life, but the way he has positioned himself against his rival in this film is really rather out of character for him as a filmmaker, considering the supporting roles he's given himself in his previous two films, though commercially you can see why he's put himself in this role. The last major problem with the film is that it never seems to know where its focus should lie. A romantic comedy set in the world of American football was always going to be a tough sell, and unfortunately the filmmakers have failed in trying to marry the two. A lack of focus is the problem here, as it never knows what it should be, and there are bizarre shifts in focus throughout. And indeed, the romantic comedy aspect is dropped altogether in the final third of the film, instead focusing on the idea of honour, doing the right thing, and going out literally fighting. While the end of the film resolves the romantic angle to no great surprise whatsoever, I cannot help but feel that those who came to the film for that angle will become rather bored by it. Saying all this though, the climactic football game does have a rather original idea for its resolution, and a rather funny one at that, and it does show that there are some sparks of life in the film. And really, it must be said that the film does occasionally do what it aims to do. There are some laughs in it, mainly with visual gags which recall the Coen brothers, who have obviously influenced Clooney in making this film. And while they are spaced out in the running time, I did laugh out loud on a few occasions. The central pair are also obviously having fun, and this lightens the film considerably. While John Krasinski brings nothing of note whatsoever to what is really a rather thankless role, Clooney and Renée Zellweger demonstrate some terrific chemistry, and their verbal sparring result in some of the best scenes in the film, their initial encounter being a particular highlight, and you kind of wish that it go along that road for the rest of the film. Stephen Root is also impressive as Clooney's confidant, bringing a lot of laughs with him also, and again he shows some great chemistry. Indeed, when Clooney is actually on screen by himself or with anyone, you always feel that the film may be able to turn a corner and launch off into something better, but it just never does. Leatherheads is one of the few missteps George Clooney has taken recently, and it is a great shame to have to report that. It is not lazy filmmaking, though it is rather self-indulgent, but when you are in his position, you would probably do the same. Pacing and lack of focus are the problems in what is a rather intriguing proposition, which provides further evidence, though, that the predominantly male sports movie and the predominantly female romantic comedy maybe shouldn't just meet all that often. Okay, that was a clip from the next review on today's show, taking a look at Wreck, which is directed by Juame Balagueiro and Paco Plaza. Sorry for murdering those names and probably the ones I'm about to. Manuela Velasco, Pablo Rosso, Jorge Serrano, Ferran Terraza, David Vert, and Carlos Vicente. Wreck is the story of a documentary team which are following around a group of firefighters, which after a rather boring start picks up a bit where the firefighters get a call from an apartment block where an old woman has started going a bit mad. They soon find out that nothing is quite what it seems in this apartment block, and in fact everything's going to get a bit fucked. The past few months have seen the found footage film, pioneered by the infamous Cannibal Holocaust, make a storming comeback. It has been 9 years since the Blair Witch Project took this idea and created one of the biggest independent films of all time, and we have seen little of it since, until the start of the year, when Cloverfield showed us what this kind of film can do, with an epic and at the same time intimate scope and a decent budget behind it. George Romero followed this up with Diary of the Dead, a film I would actually rather forget and stop talking about. In the background all this time has been Wreck, a film which has been getting a steady build-up of buzz on the net for the last few months, and is a film which has made such an impression that an American remake, Wreck being Spanish language, has already been shot, and the result, Quarantine, will be released later this year, a fact which says a lot about this film's reputation. For the last few weeks, I've grown steadily more excited by the film after reading very positive stuff about it on the Empire Online forums, and when I found out it was to play at the cinema I work in, I could not wait. I love a decent horror film, and all signs pointed towards that being exactly what I would get. This being said, the film takes a while to get going. We are introduced to the central conceit of the story, that we are following a bunch of firefighters, and just as Cloverfield took time to get started before the mayhem, so does Wreck. However, once it does get going, it stops to give us plot and characterisation for just about the whole of the middle third of the film, something we actually kind of need more of in horror cinema. After finishing the film, though, I have to wonder if the directing pair were in fact fucking with the audience the entire time. The film slows down, nothing scary happens for a long while, and it lulls you into a false sense of security before really punishing you for feeling so relaxed in its final third, because let it be said, it punishes you. This is not to say that there are no scares until the final third, as there are. The initial encounter with the horror found in the apartment block the firefighters are sent to is extremely harrowing, and earns the film its 18 certificate in the UK immediately, with some stuff which I doubt will remain intact in the US remake, as it seems to step over a few boundaries in what American cinema is prepared to show. There is also a terrific moment involving someone falling unexpectedly, which did actually make me laugh in the best possible what-the-fuck sense, which sets the mood for the style of shocks to come. No non-diegetic music here, no cats jumping out of random places to give you a little fright. Everything here is made all the more scary by the fact that it is filmed in such a realistic way that it feels as if you are there. This aspect is presented better than in Cloverfield, it must be said. The camera feels far less purposefully framed than in Cloverfield, and is far more likely to give you motion sickness than anything in that aforementioned film. Quite simply, though, once the infected people start striking, the film ramps up and does not let you go for a second. I was on the edge of my seat throughout, and in the final 10 minutes, I actually had my hand covering my eyes because of the sheer tension created, as the film gives us the single best use of night vision I have ever seen in a film, and results in an arse-clenchingly tense scene which you will just pray will finish and relieve you in some way. The film is vicious, much of it disturbing, and all of this aspect of it is well shot and paced perfectly, with no concessions to light moments of humour, as many films would do. The fact is that it is not the filmmaker's intentions, they just want to scare you. This film is not without its problems, though. One particular scene involving someone turning into one of the infected feels rather convenient for the purposes of the story, and while the shot created from it is a great one, it raises questions about how the infection can actually manifest itself. A bit of exposition towards the end of the film, while setting up the climactic scene very well, also feels as if we are being told too much. The little dribbles of information we are fed through throughout the running time feel like more than enough, and while the reveal of what is going on raises some actually really fun questions about whether it is actually an infection or something more spiritual is a unique one. And on a side note, I love the way the fact that people turn at different times is explained. It is very original. But in the end, some things may have been better off unexplained, and this only makes me fear what the American remake is going to bring to the table in this aspect. The cast are uniformly solid also, something which again could be used more in horror cinema. Our lead girl, Angela, played by Manuela Velasco, is an endearing presence who could have easily fallen into the reporter wanting a scoop and caring about nothing else kind of role easily, but never does. Instead, she is warm, friendly, and then believably terrified. Jorge Serrano is a fun presence as the Camp Sergio, and the two firefighters, played by Ferran Teresa and David Wirt, are also believable and likeable people. Everyone in this film really is actually quite likeable, and any tension created is purely because of the shared situation. Personal things never come out, they all want to stay alive but never act too crazy. It all feels real, which is the shining and most successful aspect of the film. While Wreck is not the most original horror ever made, it certainly takes an awful lot of elements from Danny Boyle's 28 Days films, it certainly is an entirely successful exercise in scaring the shit out of you. While there are elements of the plot I would have liked less of, and while there are a couple of moments which feel a tad contrived, the fact is that for a film in a genre which aims to do nothing but scare its audience, Wreck is an immensely successful picture, which in future years will be held up as an example of how to make a truly great horror. It is inventive, disturbing, and exciting stuff, which glues you to the screen while you want nothing more than to stop watching. Okay then, folks, movie news time, and got a few bits and bolts for you this week. Starting with the fact that Pixar have revealed a bit about what they're going to be doing in the future. Of course, this year's effort from them is going to be Wall-E. But coming up next year, we've got Up. Which, according to Chud.com, which I got all my news from as usual, involves Carl Fredrickson, who spent his entire life dreaming of exploring the globe and experiencing life to its fullest. But at the age 78, it seems to have passed him by, until a twist of fate gives him a new lease of life. That sounds interesting. There's some concept art on the net, and it does look like the look's going to be worth it. And I don't know, it's going to be interesting. Yeah, I mean, to be honest with you, I'm not all that excited about that, you know, I'll just be honest with you. But, yeah, and then in 2010, we're going to get Toy Story 3, which looks at the gang when Andy is old and goes off to college, which that's going to be an interesting idea, actually, and hopefully it'll be a nice conclusion to the Toy Story series. But most bizarrely of all, in 2012, so 4 years yet, we're going to get a sequel to Cars, which apparently is going to see the cars going on some sort of international adventure. I'm kind of surprised Cars is getting a sequel, considering the fact that it was pretty much the least liked of all the Pixar films so far. I believe it was one of the least successful financially as well. I mean, it's the one Pixar film where I've seen it once, and I thought I never will be asked to see this again. And yeah, it why, to be honest with you. So, yeah, I mean, that's Pixar. I really hope they're not going to fall into the sequel thing too often, to be honest with you. Nate, some rather depressing news. Trick or Treat, a Halloween anthology film, which was due to come out last year, has apparently been dropped by Warner Brothers altogether after being pushed back a couple of times. I heard some really, really good things about this, actually, and we haven't seen a good horror anthology for ages, and I believe Legendary Pictures, the production company behind it, are trying to find a new distributor behind it at the moment. Now, it's quite interesting that Chud say that they're wondering if the movie's association with Bryan Singer is part of the problem, considering the next piece of news and the last piece of news, that Bryan Singer's new film, the Tom Cruise star at Valkyrie, has been pushed back again. Originally slated to come out this summer, it got moved back to October, which some saw as a move to give it some Oscar buzz, but it's now going to get dumped out on President's Day weekend next year, where it's going to be competing with the Friday the 13th remake. And to be honest with you, I know which one I'd rather see, and it ain't Valkyrie. Tom Cruise just annoys me, as he does millions of people, apparently, even though I did quite like him in Lions for Lambs. And the film neither looks interesting, exciting, and apparently the German accent Tom Cruise sports is pretty bad. So maybe reshoots, maybe it's just getting dumped, but it never looked that thrilling anyway. The trailer which came out, which was attached to Lions for Lambs, was atrocious. A very, very boring trailer. And, yeah, I mean, it's a shame for Bryan Singer, because between this and not being able to get a Superman sequel off the ground, which is in itself quite kind of ironic, it is a shame. But then, you know, I mean, sometimes bad things happen to good people, and I suppose Bryan Singer did have a decent run of it, but you never know. I mean, like, Valkyrie may turn out to be genius yet, but on this evidence I would not think so. And far be it for me to gossip or anything, but it says a lot when a film gets pushed back twice, especially to a box office weekend where easy money can be made, as opposed to actually sticking anything with quality out. So that's it for news this week. A week even, more next week.
There's someone here.
Hello?
Sorry to disturb you, I'm staying next door.
Please, come in.
Wow, that's a really great set of clubs.
Mr. Farber.
What?
Ah! Dad!
You want to call someone? An ambulance? Or the police?
Why are you doing this?
Have a seat, please. I'm Paul. We're gonna make a bet now. You bet that you'll be alive tomorrow at 9 o'clock, and we bet that you'll be dead. Eeny, meeny, miny, mo. Catch the tiger by the toe. If he hollers, let him go. Eeny, meeny, miny, mo.
Why don't you just kill us?
You shouldn't forget the importance of entertainment.
Okay then, guys, I've been very, very much looking forward to this one. Funny Games US, directed by Michael Haneke. Funny Games US stars Naomi Watts, Tim Roth, Brady Corbett, Michael Pitt, and Devon Gerhart. Funny Games US is a remake of Haneke's film from 1997, Funny Games, and deals with a wealthy middle-class couple played by Naomi Watts and Tim Roth, and their child played by Devon Gerhart, who, upon arriving at their holiday home, are greeted by two strange men, Peter and Paul, played by Michael Pitt and Brady Corbett, who want to play some funny games with them and bet that in 12 hours they will be alive and the couple and the child will be dead. The American remake is quite the controversial topic. The business behind it, and let us never forget that films are primarily made by studios to make money, is sound. Take a concept from a foreign film and adapt it for an audience who may not get a chance to see or would not want to see the original version, because of subtitles or just the fact that it's foreign in some cases. In recent years, the American remake has been dominated by horror pictures, with anyone listening to this review knowing of at least a couple they can name. What is rarer is the remake made by the original's director. This is not unheard of, and indeed in the early 90s came one of the most infamous examples, The Vanishing, which was directed by the original version's director, George Schlusier, who listened to his producers too much and ruined the remake's impact with one of the most preposterous endings ever seen in film. Seriously, watch his original, then watch that. It's absolutely ridiculous. More recently, Hideo Nakata made the bizarre move of making a remake sequel to a remake original based on his original work, which was completely different from his original sequel with The Ring 2, which completely dropped the rather Western audience unfriendly metaphysical plot and replaced it with a standard child possession tale, which I defy anyone to sit through more than once. The latest of this particular rare breed is a remake of a film which holds a special place in my heart, Michael Haneke's Funny Games. The original film is what I can only describe as a complete act of defiance by the director, showing the audience very little of what they want and then questioning why they want it, and on a less intellectual level, a rather superb psychological drama, which constantly goes the opposite direction of where you think it will. When the remake was announced, I was immediately sceptical, but was then puzzled by learning that Haneke had made a shot-for-shot remake, which according to IMDb even used the blueprints of the original's house to make the film feel virtually identical. The thing is with Haneke is that, along with all other master directors, I feel he is actually smarter than I, that I should trust what he is doing, and so I went into the film with an open mind. Now, in the April 2008 issue of the BFI magazine Sight and Sound, the magazine's editor, Nick James, takes up the mantle of reviewing the film, and said that it could not hope to have as much of an impact as the original film, because we are more used to the things Haneke does in this film by now, and that torture porn is shown rather more. And in the end of the day, the whole exercise is rather futile, as given that Haneke has stated in many interviews over the past few months that the only reason he made the film was so more people would actually watch it, only people who watch arthouse cinema or know of Haneke's work would watch it, this according to James, and so it would be the rather pointless exercise. It's not really my place to argue with a man who, as the editor of the leading academic film journal in the UK, as he obviously has a far wider knowledge than I, but I really must disagree wholeheartedly with him. Haneke has made concessions to the mainstream in the one way that this really matters in terms of the remake: star power. Naomi Watts is a big star, who, while she can't really open movies by herself, will guarantee a level of interest which would not be generated otherwise. Also, Tim Roth is well known in wider film circles than strictly the art house, thanks in large to his part in Quentin Tarantino's Reservoir Dogs, and Michael Pitt is regarded as one of the key up-and-coming actors of the moment. In the UK, all this has made sure that the film was featured in all the major national newspaper review sections, not something all arthouse movies get, was featured on popular youth programming strands such as T4 on Channel 4 in the UK, and was featured on the Edith Bowman Show on daytime afternoon Radio 1, which is the leading youth station in the UK, and has got a release which does actually include multiplexes. Indeed, I saw this film in a multiplex, and it looked like my two friends and myself were the only people in the audience who had seen the original, judging by the other people's reactions. Even though, then again, one of my friends pissed himself whenever the crazy music which starts the film turns up in the film, which does happen a couple of times. While the film will not be a blockbuster, I think it has reached a wider audience than James gives the film credit for. On to the film itself, and it is probably best to talk of the differences to the original for those who have seen it. To be honest with you, it is virtually shot for shot. Some lines have been removed, but the music is intact. The iconic moments are intact also. One has been updated visually, though, and by and large, it is the same film. Where it differs, though, and this is actually important, I think it is more important than a lot of people have given it credit for, is in the performances. Naomi Watts and Tim Roth are respectively stronger and weaker than their original counterparts, Suzanne Lufair and Ulrich Muir. Roth in particular really brings out the impotence of the middle-class male, feeling utterly redundant from the start. It must be said, though, that Naomi Watts feels a bit too strong, especially in one drawn-out scene which felt far more believable in Lefebvre's portrayal. The two villains of the police also feel different. Michael Pitt is, in my view, not as effective as Arno Frisch in the original, as he never feels that charismatic. He always seems a bit too over the edge, even right from the very start. And considering the tricks Haneke tries to use to make the audience feel complicit in their involvement, his portrayal serves to lessen this somewhat, and that is a shame. Brady Corbett does solid work, though, and very much lives up to his counterpart, playing Don believably, and he is a welcome addition to the cast. For those of you who have not seen the original, I will not talk of the film that much for risk of spoiling what is in store. The film is both exciting and slow-moving in parts, infuriating and fiendishly brilliant in others, and is a superb example of intellectual filmmaking, which can also be seen as a twisting, turning, and harsh example of what cinema can do to your mind. The narrative about turns Haneke uses will make you wonder how you got sucked into what you believe will happen, and let it be said, Haneke punishes you often and brutally for thinking what you do throughout the film. The film is not for the faint of heart and fully earns its 18 certificate in the UK. It is a depressing piece of work which asks questions of us. And while many have said Haneke is constantly lecturing those who sit through the film, the man obviously wants it seen, if not to make us change our minds about how and why we consume media, but instead making us realise that what we want on the screen very often contradicts what we want in reality. In my view, this is healthy. The amount of violence in film is often cathartic, and indeed Haneke acknowledges this, but he also worries about where we are going as a society, and indeed this is something we must take heed of. It is intelligent, provocative filmmaking, which I very much recommend to anyone. The film is not universally loved, as the original was not either, but it certainly shows that Haneke is far smarter than I, and this is a fact that I am happy to acknowledge. For me, this remake is not a disappointment. The real question is going to be down the years which one I watch, the original or this, and to be honest with you, at the moment, I can't really decide which.
He was listed in the city directory as Thomas Howard. His children didn't know how their father made his living or why they so often moved. They didn't even know their father's name. He regretted neither his robberies nor the 17 murders that he laid claim to. And on September 5th, 1881, Jesse James was 34 years old.
Open that safe.
Who are you then?
Pop Four. I'm an authority on the James Boys.
Is you?
You know what I got right next to my bed?
Story of the James Boys by R.W. Stevens.
Well, your brother said you might want to join us.
I honestly believe I'm destined for great things, Mr. James.
Come on aboard. Glad to have you.
So, on to the first DVD review of the week. And unlike the next one, I'm actually going to do a full review of the film as well as the DVD, just because I haven't actually reviewed the film for the podcast yet. So, taking a look at the two-disc limited collector's edition of The Assassination of Jesse James by the Coward Robert Ford, which is directed by Andrew Dominik and stars Brad Pitt, Casey Affleck, Sam Rockwell, Jeremy Renner, and loads of others. It's quite a large cast, actually. The Assassination of Jesse James deals with Jesse James, played by Brad Pitt, who takes under his wing, kind of, Robert Ford, a strange young man, played by Casey Affleck. Over the course of the film, ego, celebrity, obsession, mistrust, and disturbed behaviour will all result in what is said in the title, really, but in a way, that's not really what the film is about. The winter months have seen many films come and go, a lot of these with hopes of awards attached. Some have been huge successes, Juno, No Country for Old Men, and There Will Be Blood, among the more obvious ones. Other award season films, while not winning as many of the plaudits which were originally hoped for, have been successes at least financially. The most or moist notable example, as I have written down on this computer screen here, of which being American Gangster. Damn it, I thought taking that out. There was another moist there somewhere, but I obviously didn't spot that one. Sorry. For many, though, the one film missing from both of these areas would be The Assassination of Jesse James by the Coward or Robert Ford, or T-A-O-J-J-B-T-C-R-F, as I have written down. This film had a promising pedigree. It's starring one of the world's biggest movie stars, Brad Pitt, it being produced by Ridley Scott, and its director Andrew Dominik made a huge splash with his debut feature, Chopper. Despite a protracted post-production, which saw the film's release pushed back several times, the film was celebrated by virtually every critic who managed to see it, and was named by Mark Kermode as the best film of 2007, something which, if you listen to his review, which you can on the BBC Radio 5 Live website, you would know came as quite a shock to Kermode himself more than anyone. While I had every hope of seeing this in the cinema myself, everyday life got in the way somewhat, and its still surprising limited release did not help matters. In hindsight, maybe it was for the best that I waited for the DVD release before watching the film, as I could see it without all the acclaim ringing in my ears. Saying this, though, it is a real kick in the teeth that I did not get to see this on the big screen, as it, along with There Will Be Blood, is certainly the best-looking film of 2007. This, along with No Country for Old Men and In the Valley of Ela, resulted in quite a 2007 for the film's cinematographer Roger Deakins, a man who surely would have won an Academy Award for that year if it weren't for his own work splitting the vote. The fantastic American West locales help immensely, but the way he works with light, most strikingly in the train hold-up sequence early in the film, is simply exemplary. This is not to belittle Dominic's efforts, as in this very scene we are given a succession of breathtaking shots devised by the man, and this combination of direction and cinematography is of the highest standard throughout. Many have suggested that the reason why it did not make as much impact as the other films mentioned at the start of this review is that, like the title of the film, it is rather drawn out. While the 2.5-hour running time may be initially daunting, the film never feels long. While often films can feel padded out unnecessarily, one has to only listen to my review of Leatherheads for an example of this, the fact is that, like the very best films, every second of this feels relevant. It has a sedate pace, but it's not nearly as laborious as I thought it may have been, as the feel and flow are consistent throughout. While the title of the film may suggest a rather straightforward and conventional story, the film actually becomes a complex tale of ego, celebrity and obsession, as the film focuses both on the dangerously naive and ambiguous in almost every aspect nature of Robert Ford, and the psychotic Jesse James, a man who may believe his own press a little too much. The shifting perspective of the film never gives us a handle on who our sympathies are supposed to lie with, and the seeming morally bankrupt way people react to Ford bleeds through to the real world, as in a way the viewer becomes enamoured with James, just like the people hearing of his legend in the film. If not the person, then at least what he represents. Much of this is due to Dominic's immensely creditable screenplay, which makes us question what we are thinking as much as the characters. Dominic allows us to become comfortable in James's company, and then punishes us psychologically for doing so, especially in an intense scene where James tries to get some information from a small boy. Dominic does well in not flooding the screen with James throughout, as large sections of the film contain not a whiff of him in a physical sense, though you sense he is actually always watching. The sections dealing with Robert Ford and his brothers are also interesting, though one subplot involving an indiscretion and subsequent killing feels as if they are dwelled on perhaps a little too much. Although this is integral to the plot, it feels as if it could have just been pulled a little tighter. While focusing on Ford, Dominic captures perfectly the sense of adoration slowly peeling away to leave a hard skin of resentment, which ends in nothing but suffering for all involved, and Dominic does well in never telling us what to think, and instead treats the audience with respect throughout. The performances are also of a top standard. Brad Pitt takes his real-life celebrity status and integrates it perfectly into this older time. He always looks as if a million things are going through his mind at once, but also manages to shock when he unleashes what he usually keeps hidden. Casey Affleck is scarily effective as the optimistic youngest child who has everything crushed, and his pain and suffering become ever more etched into his performance throughout. Sam Rockwell also deserves mention for his role, but it really is Pitt and Affleck's show throughout. In all, this film is fully deserving of a place with the best films of 2007, and is a modern classic. Along with No Country and There Will Be Blood, it is a triumphant show of intelligent, haunting and beautiful cinema, which must be the most overlooked film of last year. Ignore any preconceptions you may have of it and just immerse yourself. I think you won't regret taking the time to do so. Onto the DVD itself, and the film is presented in a 2.35:1 anamorphic transfer, which is very, 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 very nice. Nothing really bad to say about it, to be honest with you. The film is given room to breathe by the fact that the only extra is shifted over to the second disc, and this is replicated in the audio, which is a pretty flawless 5.1 surround mix, which, while not as involving as perhaps it could have been, does still present plenty to excite. Extras wise, disappointing. You got on the 2-disc limited collector's edition, you've got a half an hour long documentary, Death of an Outlaw, which is a slightly muddled half an hour look at the creation of the Jesse James myth, and a look at what the man actually was, which basically involves half an hour of you realizing that, yes, okay, fine, the film is probably an accurate portrayal, we get it. And that's it, actually. It's a, like a DVD I'll talk about later, the extras disappoint. And to be honest with you, if I knew this before going in, I would have just bought the one disc. Even though, in the UK anyway, the one disc cover art is ugly as fuck. It's just a picture of Jesse James looking at you, and it's just brown and horrible and bleh. Whereas the two-disc artwork is nicer. So, in all, I mean, it's a terrific film. It's a very good transfer, both video and audio, but the extras are a bit shit, really.
That's not my ringtone.
You have one new message.
That's your voice. That's you. Dying.
Ever since that bizarre phone call, I keep seeing things.
Leanne got a phone call, and so did Shelley, right before they died.
The girl's right. There's got to be some kind of connection here.
It's like you get a voicemail.
Call came in 2 nights ago.
You hear your death.
They get in your head, Beth.
And then you die.
Look, these things work here. They get in your head, Beth.
Right. Another Hollywood remake of an Asian horror film. One Missed Call, directed by Eric Vallette. One Missed Call stars Shannon Sossaman, Ed Burns, Megan Good, and Johnny Lewis. And is the story of a mystery which leads to somebody's phone being dialed and rung. The people get a voicemail from the time of their own death, detailing their own death, and then once they die, someone in their phone book gets a call, and so it continues. Oh God, you can tell from my voice what I already think about this film. I came to One Missed Call, though, in a rather unique position for myself. Pretty much every American remake of a horror film that has come through the last few years has been based on a film I've previously seen. But Takashi Miike's original only became widely available in the UK, with a DVD release time to coincide with this film a couple of weeks ago, so I have not seen it. I thought it would be interesting, though, to watch one of these films without having any baggage from what I had seen before, and without knowing what was going to happen. Frankly, poisonous reviews for the film did not bode well, but I tried to go in with as neutral a stance as possible. In the end of the day, I had never heard of the director, and while the central idea is rather ridiculous, I thought that maybe we could get some decent shocks at the very least. As hope often turns into disappointment, I was not really surprised by my general stance on the film in the end, but I was rather surprised at how I came to the conclusion, as this film could actually be seen as a dead-on parody of this stream of films, and I genuinely laughed out loud at several points. One early moment involving a cat meeting a rather unlucky demise had me laughing so hard that a couple in front of me actually turned around and looked at me. Now, laughing can often be seen as a coping mechanism in horror films, giving you the sort of respite from what is unfolding on screen, but that really was not the case with this film. The things which are supposed to be scary just look rubbish, and my natural expression was laughter. A combination of really poor CGI, ridiculous visual ideas, particular highlights include a disembodied arm dialing a phone, which makes no sense even in the context of the film, and a moment involving a baby late in the film, and also what appear to be poor rubber masks, which all combine to create the impression that this film is trying to make us laugh. Now I note that this is not the case. All of this is not helped by what is a really rather awful screenplay. While the central mystery holds promise early in the film, this is completely thrown away later in the film, when the questions of how they thought they could get away with what happens on screen mount up, and you are left with the impression that they did not even try to have the film make sense. Without going into spoilers too much, just in case you do see it, I will say that the eventual villain's motivations and just how they manage to off people in the way they do is never ever explained, and instead you just feel the filmmakers are begging you to just go with it, please go with it. The idea of phone calls preempting people's deaths is a weak one to start with, but the way in which the plot is resolved, or really not as it turns out, is nothing short of laughable. The climactic scenes including magic reanimating corpses, something which again makes no sense whatsoever in the context of the film, and a final confrontation which ends in the question of why they couldn't have just done that in the first place, are some of the worst examples of horror cinema I have seen in a mainstream cinema release in some time, and that is saying something considering the poor state of affairs we find ourselves in with genre cinema at the moment. The only positive aspect I can really find from this film is that the direction shows a lot more flair than I was expecting. I don't know, but I would assume Eric Vallette was a music video director before he made this film, as he actually comes up with some decent shots which breathe some life into the film at times, and to be honest, the direction feels better than the material it shows. So, back to the bad. And the final aspect, the cast. Ed Burns, a jobbing indie actor who seems to be listening to his agent too much these days, what with this and his role in 27 Dresses, looks embarrassed to be in the film, but to be honest, he doesn't help with an entirely one-note and wooden performance. Shannon Sossaman fares a little better, but is not helped by cartoonish flashbacks, which would seem to suggest that with her background, maybe she is the one who would actually go mad and seek vengeance on people for no reason whatsoever, instead of the antagonist we are presented with. Everyone else lasts about 5 minutes before getting off, although I would have liked to have seen more of Ray Wise, who does the slimy character very well. This is one of the shortest reviews I have actually done for this podcast, but to be honest, there really is nothing else to say about the film. It will be a fun DVD rental to watch while getting more and more drunk, and this is the only way I could recommend watching the film. While there are laughs to be had, the fact is that it's supposed to be a horror, which is something I forgot quite a bit while watching this simply laughable film. It really is just rubbish, really.
I'm so sorry. If you have a milkshake, and I have a milkshake, and I have a straw, there it is. That's the straw, you see. Watch it. And my straw reaches across the room and starts to drink your milkshake. I drink your milkshake. I drink it up.
Don't bully me, Daniel.
Those of you who recognise that will know what I'm going to be talking about now. I love that clip. Taking a look at the Region 1 2 disc collector's edition of There Will Be Blood. So I'm not going to talk about the film too much just because... there is a review already, actually, in my There Will Be Jumpers episode, which you can go ahead and download if you want to know my thoughts on the film if you haven't already. You know, nothing's changed, really. It loses a little bit of impact on the small screen, but the video is actually pretty... damn good, actually. As always, I'd love to see a high def release of it, but the video does not disappoint. The audio is also terrific, which actually, it does replicate the feeling in the cinema if you've got a 5.1 surround system. The score just envelops everything, and there are decent directional and surround effects throughout, but I mean, like, the score is the key, really, and the effect is fully replicated on this DVD. So on to the extras. I got the 2-disc collector's edition, I'll be honest, because of the artwork more than anything. I'm not usually an artwork kind of guy, I'm not usually that bothered, but I gotta say, I love the 2-disc's artwork. The image is nice. It doesn't have, like, awards quotes all over the place. And it comes in a really nice cardboard slipcase, which you open it up to reveal a little cardboard book, which has a page from Upton Sinclair's Oil novel, which the film screenplay was based on, which shows the ladies and gentlemen, I travelled just over half the state to be here today, blah, 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 which shows that was actually taken pretty directly from the novel itself. You open it up, there's a picture of H.W. and Daniel Plainview, and I believe that would be Paul Sunday, and two little notches in the cardboard to get the discs out. So it's a very nice, a very eco-friendly package, actually. So on to the extras. To be honest with you, I think it could have fit on one disc if it wasn't for the fact that the film is long, and for the video and audio quality to be as good as they are, you'd have to shift any extras onto the second disc. So what you do get, to be honest with you, it's not really worth it. It's quite a disappointing package. First of all, you get a 15... I'll say what they are, it says on the back, and then I'll explain. 15 minutes, pics, research, etc. for the making of There Will Be Blood, which is literally what it says on the tin, scored to Johnny Greenwood's music. And it's quite boring, actually. Trailers. Yeah, you got two trailers for the film. Fishing sequence and haircut slash interrupted him are two deleted sequences. The fishing sequence, actually, I think could have been in the film, but the haircut interrupted him is just stuff, really. It feels like padding. Daily's Gone Wild. Sounds a bit more salacious than it actually is, for it is just a scene of Daniel Day-Lewis, an alternate take of him and HW sitting down to a meal, and Daniel Plainview overhearing what's a guy from National Oil, I think it is talking about at another table. It's just an alternate take, you know. Hey, and then the most bizarre thing, the story of Petroleums from 1923, black and white silent film chronicling the oil business in the 1920s, is that really, it's just an educational piece with music by Johnny Greenwood. And the whole package is rather eccentric, really, and in a way it kind of fits the film, but you know, I would have loved to have had a commentary. God, who would not want to hear Daniel Day-Lewis and Paul Thomas Anderson talk about this film? Or at least a documentary or something, because, you know, it's a landmark film. It really is. I mean, it didn't do as well as at the awards as maybe it hoped it would have, but it is still a landmark film. It is still an amazing piece of work, which I feel deserved a bit more than this. I mean, I think I said much the same about the No Country for Old Men DVD, but at least you had some behind the scenes stuff which gave you some idea, whereas with this, I mean, it's more of a mystery actually, just watching the extras, really, which maybe was the point. So to be honest with you, I'd go with the one disc. You save yourself a bit of money, the artwork's not as nice, but in the end of the day, you get the film, and that really, out of this package, that's what matters. The video and the audio are both great, but yeah, it's just a very, very disappointing package, really. And I did hope for more, but you know, I bought it for the film, so you know, that much it's satisfactory, and it certainly doesn't lose anything on repeat viewing. But if you're looking for anything mind-blowing extras wise you're not going to get it from There Will Be Blood, the two disc collector's edition.
Test complete, preparing to power down and begin diagnostics.
Yeah, tell you what, do a weather and ATC check, start listening in on ground control.
Sir, there are still terabytes of calculations needed before an actual flight is advised.
Jarvis, sometimes you gotta run before you can walk. Ready? In 3, 2, 1.
So, a clip you would have just heard there would have been from Iron Man, something which will pop up on this next feature, my top 5 most anticipated films of April, May and June. Now, considering it's the summer months, there's not a lot actually coming out in the UK major in the next 3 months. I know the US release dates for things are different as well, and I must just say that the when I say April, May, June, I mean April, May, June, UK. So I believe Wally's coming out in June in the US, but it's coming out in July over here, which otherwise would definitely have featured on my list. So that's one thing. But to start off, I'm just going to go through a few films that didn't make the top five. Just you know, so starting off with In Bruges, which will be reviewed next week. I love the trailer. I love the plot that I've heard of. Two hitmen have to stay in a small medieval town in Belgium after a botched hit job, while they await instructions from their boss, played by Ralph Fiennes, and go slowly mad. I think Colin Farrell and Brendan Gleeson look like they're going to do well together, and I've heard very good things about it, to be honest with you, so there will be a review of that next week, and we shall see what happens. Also, The Ruins, which came out in the US the last weekend, and apparently, according to IMDb, comes out in the UK next week, which I was not actually aware of, which is not usual, considering me. Now, I love me a good horror film, as I said earlier on in my review of Wreck, and The Ruins is apparently absolutely brutal, absolutely thrilling, and just old-school horror. So, I think it's going to be great, to be honest with you. I mean, vines under the skin and whatnot, that's just very shivers down your spine, isn't it? Yeah, so, I mean, that should be interesting. And also, The Happening, the new film by M. Night Shyamalan Ding Dong. Interesting premise, that of something makes a load of people kill themselves, and it appears to be some sort of airborne virus or something, but the trailer doesn't look that great. And knowing old Shyamalan Ding Dong, it'll probably all turn out to be something to do with faith. So I hold little hope, but the premise has me interested enough. And finally, Forgetting Sarah Marshall, which will be reviewed on the show in 2 weeks' time. The new produced by Judd Apatow film, starring Jason Segel, one of the mates in Knocked Up, and also Kristen Bell, and something that's got me particularly interested, UK comedian Russell Brand. For those of you in the US, you might not know who Russell Brand is, but after Forgetting Sarah Marshall, you certainly bloody will do. He's an ex-drug addict who uses his ex-drug addict antics to kind of fuel his hyper-intense comedy. There really is nobody else like him in the UK, and he's an absolute joy to watch. His stand-up stuff has to be seen to be believed. And I think he's going to be the breakout star of Forgetting Sarah Marshall, and it's a film I still very much look forward to. But coming up to my top five, and let's see how many you could guess, because it's probably going to be quite a few. Starting up with number five, Neil Marshall's Doomsday, coming out on the 8th of May in the UK. It's already come out in the US, and I believe it's been and gone, but the trailer looks incredible. 28 Days Later meets Mad Max. The production design looks like something straight out of the 80s, or like Escape from New York or something. And I'm just very, very intrigued. It's coming out in quite an interesting time in the UK, that being the week between Iron Man and Speed Racer. And I kind of think it's going to get crushed by both of them, to be honest with you. But I do very much look forward to it. Neil Marshall's the director that I've been watching for quite a while now, with his first two features, Dog Soldiers, which I was quite impressed with, but then The Descent, which, if you haven't seen it, it's a great claustrophobic, intense horror film, the likes of which we don't see enough of. And I think with Doomsday, he's got a budget to match his vision, just about, and I think it's really going to be one to watch, so you very much look forward to reviewing that, and there will be a review on the show, which will be out on the 8th of May. It definitely will be out on Friday, the 9th of May, sorry, because on the Saturday I'm flying out to Spain for a week, so, well, I should be anyway. I haven't actually got my passport yet, but I should be flying out to Spain for a week, so otherwise you'll have to wait for a bit for that one, but yeah. So, number four, Speed Racer. Yeah, I know what a lot of you would probably say, what the fuck? Speed Racer has only got me interested because of the trailers, which looks like Mario Kart on acid, which is something I'm quite intrigued by, to be honest. The premise of the story looks pretty much Speed Racer likes to drive fast, and he has to beat everybody before he gets killed by an evil corporation. Fair enough. What I love about this is that this film is either going to be something absolutely incredible or an absolute train wreck. And, I mean, I don't think anyone's going to have in the middle opinion about Speed Racer, and that's one of the things that actually excites me about it. I very much think you are going to be one way or the other, and I mean, the Wachowski brothers certainly need to do something to restore their reputations after the second two Matrix films and then writing V for Vendetta, which, to be honest with you, I didn't think was all that bad, even though I know a lot of people hate it. But, you know, it is an interesting one. It comes out, I believe, May the 15th or 16th in the 16th in the UK. And it's definitely going to be one I'm going to be keeping my eye on. So, yeah. So, moving on. And if anyone can't guess what the three are in this top three, then you haven't been listening to my podcast. And so, number three, The Incredible Hulk. Coming out worldwide, I believe, on June the 13th. The Incredible Hulk is a quasi-reboot of the first Hulk film, directed by Ang Lee in 2003. And sees Edward Norton writing, producing, probably directing, really, as Bruce Banner. And, yeah, this time he's got a face-off against Tim Roth's Abomination. Tim Roth's casting excites me. Louis Leterrier, director of Transporter 2's position does not really, even though I must say the Transporter films are fun, but it's just this big budget, kind of big scale film, not too sure. So, yeah, Ed Norton, I think I said this on the podcast a little while back, I don't see him as Bruce Banner, and it's going to take a lot more convincing for me, to be honest with you. And, you know, the only reason why I am so excited about it as I am is because of the trailer, which I actually thought was really promising. I know a lot of people gave it a lot of shit, but I quite liked it. But, you know, we haven't got long to go now, June the 13th, and let's see if this resurrects or buries the franchise for good. Number two, a clip you heard earlier on, Iron Man. Any other top five anticipated list, and this would probably come first. I cannot wait for this film. Everybody at work cannot wait for this film. I can stand there and watch the trailer repeated forever. I must watch that trailer when I'm at work three or four times a day. I just stand there and watch it. It looks incredible. Robert Downey's casting is inspired, and I'm amazed the insurance people let him. But, you know, and I think Jon Favreau as director is also very interesting. Terrence Howard, I think, is going to be a good best friend. I think Gwyneth Paltrow seems to have enough kind of spunk to her role to pull it off. Even though I haven't read the comics, so, you know, I can't really tell. And to be honest with you, it just looks like some of the most fun. I was about to say the most fun, but maybe not. We're going to have in the cinema this summer, to be honest with you. Yeah, I can't wait for Iron Man. And the clip you heard at the start of this section was actually a clip of the film that's been released, which I believe is available on Yahoo, which is very, very fun. So, moving on to my number one. Can you guess what it is yet? Indiana Jones and the Kingdom of the Crystal Skull, of course. May 22nd, worldwide, this fucker comes out. Oh my god, it's going to be a beast, isn't it? I know we are predicting it to take £2.5 million in the UK on the first day alone, on the Thursday, and then £10 million over the weekend. Now, if you think about it, £10 million over the weekend, that's $20 million in the US. But also consider how small the UK is compared to America. You get an idea. This film's going to be massive. I think it's got a chance of breaking the 3-day record, opening weekend record in the US set by Spider-Man 3 last year. And I think it's probably going to be the highest grossing film of the summer. Everything about it so far, apart from the disturbing presence of a lot of self-referential one-liners in the trailer, has me very much anticipating it. I think Ray Winstone is going to be terrific as the sidekick. I think Shia LaBeouf is going to be also terrific as another sidekick, and I think Kate Blanchett is going to show some meanness, which we haven't seen from her pretty much ever. And that is something I'm very much looking forward to. Even though I must say, anybody who thinks she's hot in that get-up, you got something wrong with you. Indiana Jones and the Kingdom of the Crystal Skull is my number one. We don't know a lot about the plot yet, but it does involve aliens, which is interesting. But we have not got long to wait, have we now? May 22nd. So that is it. And so in celebration of that number one, here's a little clip from a newly released TV spot.
Professor, this really is a dead end.
Come on, genius.
Don't go, Timo!
This film is not yet rated.
And that is it for this week's show. Thank you very much for listening. Coming up on next week's definite reviews of Son of Rambo, as I mentioned at the start, and also the new Colin Farrell starring in Bruges, which opens in the UK next week. I'd just like to say as well, just in case you haven't heard me say this before, my reviews are based on UK release dates, just for the fact this is a UK-based podcast, and it enables a bit more stuff that makes sense, I suppose, in terms of release schedules, instead of reviewing stuff all over the place, blitz and bobs. And also, it also means I don't have to illegally download stuff, which I'd really rather not. So, yeah, so basically, I know In Bruges came out in the US on limited release a couple of months ago, but you're going to hear a review next week. But then again, Son of Rambo, I believe, hasn't come out in the US yet, so you guys have got a little preview of that, so swings and roundabouts. So, yeah, also, definitely some other reviews, even though I've got no idea what, and my next top five, taking a look in a conjunction with In Bruges at my top five Hitman films. So, until next week, any feedback is welcome. Please email cineramapodcast@yahoo.co.uk or Skype the voicemail line at cineramapodcast, all one word, all lowercase. And until then, have a good week. Let's get some feedback, guys. And, yeah, have a good one. Cheers. Bye.